Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I'm glad to be here along with my great audio engineer for another episode, another show, another podcast. Okay, so we're throttleupradio.com is our website. We are on Red State Talk Radio on the weekends. We're a weekend show on that great radio station, and we also podcast. Our podcast is Throttle Up or Throttle Up Radio, and that's found on all podcast platforms that we are aware of, so it's easy to find us across the board. Okay, so another episode. We are raring to go. Let me start off by talking a little bit about the way I see the world, the way I see what is occurring in this great nation of ours, and basically the way I see things. Now, my perspective, fair warning, looking at my audio engineer, she probably thinks I'm half crazy. Fair warning, my perspective might be different, a little bit different. Could be quite a bit different than what you have encountered in the past, but that's okay because my perspective needs to be different. Of course, it should be, and we need to look at a number of perspectives as we go forward. Okay, so in other words, broaden our awareness. And as Ian McGilchrist presents in his book and talks, our attention. He talks about attention in a big way. Okay, so we are in the midst of discussing on this show and other shows. The tip of the spear. What does that mean? Tip of the spear. You've heard it before. We also heard in harm's way is another term that is often used. And what does that mean in terms of, well, in terms of national defense, in terms of support and defend the Constitution, in terms of protection from harm, all of that stuff, the blanket of protection, is another term that is often used, used in the movie A Few Good Men, by the way, and other terms like that. What exactly does that mean? What does it mean to be in that position? Okay, so I operated when I was in the Navy. I was a Navy fighter pilot, deployed aboard the aircraft carrier, which happened to be the USS Constellation. And I was operating at the tip of the spear. Now, what exactly did that mean and what was going on? Well, there was a lot of things going on, but we were deployed in the Pacific Theater. That's kind of like the up-and-coming. That's the hotbed right now, by the way, in terms of military thinking. Across the board, that's number one item is the Pacific Theater of Operation, and also the Great Power Conflict. We are now getting back into that mindset. We've been away for a while. This country has been away fighting regional wars and skirmishes and doing all kinds of things on a piecemeal basis, but now we're back. Most of us, as it turns out, I'm not the only one. Most of us, that as far as I can tell, most of us are back talking about and dealing with and planning for and building the capabilities such that we can engage the enemy who happens to be a great power adversary. So we can perform well in a great power conflict. Now, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to repeat it on a regular basis, so just be aware of it. This is like one of these Kevin things that I like to repeat. All right, so you're gonna hear. I've already said this before, but you're gonna hear it quite a bit. All right, a great power conflict means that you are operating at the high end of the conflict spectrum. Okay, I think that that term originated at the Naval War College. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that I am correct on that. I think they were the first ones who came up with that term. You might say they coined that term, not sure, but let's just say that we're going to give them credit. All right, so they get credit for the term high end of the conflict spectrum. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to my great audio engineer. She's going to start the show off with a question, as she normally does. We do this on a regular basis. So here she is with the question for this week.
Okay, greetings to you, Kevin, and to your listening audience. Okay, you have made the statement that the aircraft carrier at sea is the tip of the spear. What do you mean by that?
Okay, yes, great question. And it requires a little bit of time, a little bit of explanation. The answer comes to us in a number of ways, in a number of forms. Don't expect a single answer. Okay, so don't expect a single thought trajectory. There's many things that enter into this arena brings us to the point, to the conclusion that this, in fact, is at the tip of the spear. First and foremost, when I was deployed in the Pacific, I was trained to operate at the high end of the conflict spectrum. Okay, so we expected, we were training for a well-equipped enemy, proficient and professional and committed to our destruction. All right, so we were trained to defeat this well-positioned, well-committed enemy, and so we were dealing with a great power conflict, and we were dealing with combat activities at the high end of the conflict spectrum. And also, this was around the clock combat operations, all right? So this is a 24-hour warfare, if you want to put it that way. We had to operate not only at sea, but we had to operate day and night, anytime in the 24-hour clock, and in all kinds of weather, you know, and certainly up to some obvious limitations on the weather. The weather can get pretty nasty in the Pacific, particularly in the summer. During typhoon season, it get really nasty and dangerous. I remember when I was on the USS Constellation, we were operating in the Pacific for a long period of time, and at one point in that operation, we were trying to outrun a typhoon. You're probably looking at me like, my audio engineer is probably looking at me like I lost my mind. No, we were actually trying to outrun a typhoon, right? So we were steaming at 30 knots for, well, a good, I would say probably a good couple of days, and we were bent on outrunning it. We actually finally did, and we were we were doing that at that time. This is really fascinating because I remember this really quite vividly. We were operating along with the USS Coral Sea. So there were two carriers out there in the Pacific, and we were basically, we were relieving the Coral Sea on station, right? So the Coral Sea had been out there for a while. I was on the USS Constellation, which was a bigger carrier. It's the super carrier. Coral Sea was the midway class, so that's the middle-sized carrier. And we were steaming together to outrun this typhoon, and we were side by side. So the Coral Sea was, I remember looking at it, I would say probably 3 miles away, 2 or 3 miles away. It was pretty close. And I could vividly see it, and I was we were outrunning it, and I had gone up to the flight deck and launched and tied myself to the flight deck so I wouldn't get blown over. And I was watching the Coral Sea, and the Coral Sea was taking green water over the bow. That is how rough the seas were. They were huge, huge waves, as you would expect. And so there is some limitations to how we operate, but most of the time a aircraft carrier at sea can operate 24/7, okay? And we train to do that, by the way. We train to do that, and we get really good at it, I would say. And great credit to everyone out there, everyone that goes to sea, everyone that operates on carriers, everyone that participates in the maintenance and the fueling and the preparation and the fire suppression and the search and rescue and the power plant technicians and the intelligence officers and you name it. I mean, we're talking about 5,000 people on board the carrier, 5,000. And then the carrier task force, we have a lot of other ships along with us to make up a task force. Task force could be as large as 100 ships. Typically, it's not that large, but it's pretty large, sure. Carrier is usually the flagship, so the carrier task force commander, which happens to be a two-star admiral, carrier task force commander is usually aboard the carrier. In other words, he has his flag aboard that particular man of war. All right, so we're going to play an audio clip here. It's actually a video clip as well. It's called Flight Deck. It's a 1988 documentary. It's got some good stuff in it in terms of what is it like to be at the tip of the spear in this environment, in this really quite challenging environment. It's none of it is without its own built-in challenges. You can say that that whatever we are doing, we're operating under adverse conditions, okay? You can say that. You can say, well, an aircraft carrier, say, is there any such thing as a normal day or normal conditions with an aircraft carrier at sea? And I would say, no, there isn't, not really. We are always operating under adverse conditions in one form or another. It could be night, it could be dusk, it could be weather, it could be rain, it could be, you name it, all right? It's always adverse conditions, and we are prepared for that because we can operate very effectively under those conditions. It takes a great deal of training, and it also takes commitment, and it takes dedication to the mission as well. And so my hat's off to all of the people, all of the warriors that participated in carrier operations from World War II to the present, and even before World War II. I'm not diminishing their value because the early carrier operators and aviators did quite a bit of work to prepare ourselves to fight effectively during World War II. And from there to the present, it's really an unbroken record of excellence is what we have. And I was proud to be part of that that whole enterprise and that whole era of carrier operations. I happened to be flying the FA Crusader, which was a handful, I would say, pretty much a handful of fly, and nothing about the FA Crusader was easy. It was, in fact, one of the top performing airplanes at that time in terms of fighter performance. A very high performance airplane, extremely high performance. But it was a challenging thing to fly, like a thoroughbred racehorse, fast but flighty and touchy, if you will, and unforgiving in a lot of areas. Okay, so let's go ahead and play this audio clip. We're going to play it for, about 15 minutes, is that right?
That's what you said.
Yeah, and we're going to start off almost at the beginning. It's got some really good stuff. And it's produced by, who produced that? Mike?
By Mike Guardia.
Oh, okay, yeah, Mike Guardia produced it. He's kind of a famous... I'll get more information about Mike. I think I know him because his name is familiar to me, and I think in my early years as a naval aviator, I think I met him on some occasions. Anyway, so let's go ahead and play this. Flight Deck, 1988 documentary is the name of it. Got some really good stuff. Here we go.
In this case, a supercarrier on one of the world's seven seas, on deployment with more than 5,000 officers and men for more than half a year. A self-sufficient, fast-moving, floating airbase, remarkable for that. And because, as one commander put it, it's like steering Manhattan Island around from the top of the Empire State Building. What is more remarkable is the skill that goes into making it do what it does, despite being as small as it is. A veteran pilot described the flight deck as O'Hare and Washington National Airports at peak hours, squeezed into a few basketball courts. A tight and dangerous environment in which inches or inattention can mean catastrophe. But, he added, think of it also as the most formidable floating weapons system ever devised. The aircraft carrier, having demonstrated its value in World War II, and in the years to follow, in Korea, Vietnam, the carrier has, during those years, developed and implemented many new and advanced technologies. Nuclear power has given the carrier unlimited range and mobility. The canted or angled deck, first explored by the British and introduced into the U.S. Navy in 1952, and now employed on all aircraft carriers, has substantially improved the flight deck efficiency and the safety for pilots and flight deck personnel. No longer does a pilot have to face parked aircraft as he lands. A missed arrestment now is no more than a touch and go. The steam catapult, another British invention, has increased launching power over six times that of the old hydraulic systems, thus effectively increasing the complement of aircraft that can be carried aboard, together with increasing the strike power of the heavier type of aircraft that can now be launched. The landing signal officer guiding an approaching aircraft onto the deck with paddles has been replaced by a variety of more sophisticated technologies, such as the Fresnel optical landing system, or Meatball, and the landing signal officer's heads-up display console, which can give quick and precise guidance information to the pilot of an approaching aircraft under any light, weather, and sea conditions. And what all this technology has achieved is the most concentrated offensive airborne firepower from an airbase at sea. This is the home of the carrier's air wing of more than 75 airplanes, 9 or 10 squadrons, each with its own type of aircraft, each with a distinct offensive or defensive role to play. The aircraft carrier's purpose is to move its air wing close enough to any threat so as to take the battle to the enemy in any weather. Enabling its strike aircraft to put bombs on the target. And to allow its interceptors to reach and get the jump on hostile platforms. Aside from the air wing's ability to come to the carrier's defense, the boat, as the men affectionately call it, and its planes also rely on the vessels that lead, surround, and tail it. The flat top goes to sea as the core of the battle group, which may be composed of as many as a dozen fighting ships, each with its own mission, each joined to the others by a network of electronic data links. Though dispersed and separated from the carrier by hundreds of miles, yet linked electronically, its submarines, missile cruisers, frigates, and supply ships can continue to carry out their individual and integrated missions. But most important, the battle group is able to extend its operational capabilities far beyond the horizon. Though the carrier will leave home with everything it needs, resupplies of food, jet fuel, ordnance, medical items, replacement parts, everything from engines to earplugs can be delivered thousands of miles away. And so, there are the resupply ships, able to rendezvous with the battle group whenever and wherever they're needed. In addition to the air wing personnel aboard the carrier, about half the ship's complement includes the carrier's permanent personnel, who are responsible for making all the ship's systems work. When not deployed overseas or on a cruise, the air wing is shore-based at naval air stations around the United States. Before they go to sea, pilots, naval flight officers, enlisted air crewmen, and all support people go through intensive training cycles ashore, where the skills that make an air wing work as an integrated unit are taught. Simulators for each aircraft make it possible for air crews to become proficient with everything from cockpit procedures to nighttime carrier landings to sophisticated combat maneuvers conducted in incredibly realistic environments. One location for actual practice is at Fallon Naval Air Station in Nevada, where individual squadrons come together as an air wing to learn to fight as a team. The closest to the real thing is practiced against squadrons of different type aircraft, simulating enemy fighters, flying enemy tactics. Intercepts and strikes coordinated with electronic jamming and deception measures are then conducted on ranges against ground targets defended by simulated SAM missiles and ground missile sites. The results are then critiqued with the help of the Cubic Corporation's real-time visual display of who made it and who didn't. Strike Warfare Center School. 3 weeks of flying around the clock for the carrier air wing. Once integrated training at Fallon has been completed, and before overseas deployment can take place, the air wing will have to demonstrate its operational capabilities by taking a final exam and several weeks of demonstrating operational readiness at sea. But the true test of whether the objective has been met will be an ongoing one, resting on the officers and men who will handle and fly these airplanes at sea. During a typical air operation, the rescue helicopter is the first to leave the deck and hover in standby status near the ship. Tankers would take up their positions overhead to be available for airborne refueling demands, day or night. In a mission requiring fully integrated support, the E-2C Hawkeye, with its all-seeing radar rotodome, would be up and on station to keep a far-ranging eye on any air or surface threat hundreds of miles away from the battle group, and using voice or silent data link transmissions, vector the fleet's fighters to intercept and neutralize any danger. The variable swept-wing F-14 Tomcat fighter interceptor, designed for all-weather fleet, air defense, and air superiority, would follow. It can defeat enemy aircraft from sea level to an altitude of over 80,000 feet, from dogfight range to more than 700 nautical miles away. One of its prime missions is to destroy enemy bombers before they get close enough to launch their cruise missiles. The A-6E Intruder is the Air Wing's low-level, all-weather, long-range, day and night attack bomber. With a crew of two, a pilot and BN, or bombardier navigator, and able to carry missiles and rockets, it would be launched to deliver 5 2,000-pound general-purpose bombs or up to 28 500-pound bombs on targets hidden by darkness or weather. Aside from supporting strike aircraft with its electronic countermeasure systems, the EA-6B Prowler would be called upon to play a key role in defending the fleet. The EA-6B uses its electronic capabilities to protect the carrier battle group against long-range bombers, radar-homing anti-ship missiles, and is able to clear the way for Navy and Marine strike aircraft to disorient enemy air defense systems by jamming or destroying them with the HARM missile. The A-7 Corsair is the Air Wing's light attack strike day bomber and close air support aircraft. It can carry air-to-air and air-to-ground missiles, general-purpose bombs, and is outfitted with a 20-millimeter cannon. It is in the process of being replaced by the multi-mission FA-18 Hornet Naval Strike Fighter, now joining Carrier Air Wings, a high-performance, multi-mission, single-piloted aircraft. A balance of high aerodynamic performance, digital avionics, and high reliability and maintainability make it an effective replacement for the F-4 Phantom, the A-7 Corsair. It is capable of conducting fighter missions beyond 400 nautical miles. The S-3 Viking has a crew of four and can attack submarines at long ranges under all weather conditions. The S-3 can also lay mines, attack ships over the horizon with its Harpoon missile, and refuel other air wing aircraft using a buddy store. It carries 60 sonobuoys and can range 1,000 miles for more than 2 hours without refueling. The four-man SH-3 Sea King twin-turbine-powered helicopter with its dipping sonar can detect, identify, track, and destroy enemy submarines, as well as perform search and rescue missions and cargo transfer operations. And there's the COD, Carrier Onboard Delivery, a long-range transport roomy enough to deliver jet engines, critical spare parts and personnel, as well as pick up and deliver the welcome mail from home. While some carriers may differ in structure and layout, the focus of all carrier operations is here on the roof or flight deck, with its four steam catapults to shoot aircraft off the end of the deck with enough velocity to allow them to fly. And with four arresting wires to capture returning aircraft. All of it watched over, presided over, some say owned, by the man in the yellow shirt, the air boss, who is a commander and veteran pilot, who now serves as a kind of ground and air traffic controller, airport manager, and key safety officer, all rolled into one. He's assisted by a similarly qualified aviator known as the mini boss. Air crews, in fact, all hands look to the Air Boss as the officer with the final responsibility for safely launching and recovering all aircraft. His commanding view is some 140 feet above the sea in a glass and steel enclosed bubble known as PryFly, or primary flight control, which for greater visibility protrudes from the ship's towering superstructure. Commander Greg Southgate is the Air Boss on the USS Constellation. His short definition of his job: to ensure that things are done by the book.
What we do here is I have a very large communications suit that enables me to talk to all the people I have to talk to, including the aircraft, obviously, to do all this coordination. And I also have a lot of windows to watch the deck and to see the way we do things, to make sure it's safe, to make sure that we're not going to run one airplane into another. We work in very, very close quarters with our aircraft. So we track the airplanes when they launch to make sure that we get them all back. We track their fuel states. We track the condition of the airplanes, because periodically an airplane will have a problem airborne and we need to know when to bring him back, when not to bring him back. Maybe we have to get the others on board before we take a chance of bringing him back, so that should something happen to him, I don't have a bunch of others out there and no place to land them. People on the flight deck are all color-coded by their jerseys. And the reason for that is quick recognition. We've got probably 5 or 6 different color shirts that we put people in. For example, I wear a yellow shirt, which is kind of traditional for the Air Boss in the Air Department. But also, the yellow shirts generally designate directors. These people are the ones who are more qualified. They are the ones who physically tell the pilots how to maneuver their airplanes as they're taxiing around the deck. We also have the blue shirts, who are my handlers. Those are generally my younger fellows. And they are primarily there to tie down the airplanes, to chain them down. I've got purple shirts, who are my aviation fuels people. I've got white shirts, who are generally safety-type individuals, monitoring safety all around the deck. Also, my corpsmen, my medical people, are in white. The aircraft troubleshooters, who are members of the squadrons, are in white. So that if an air crew calls and says, I need to see a troubleshooter, I know when one has arrived on the scene, and that way I know the airplane's getting the help he needs. We have green shirts, and those are all my catapult and arresting people. Resting gear folks are all in green shirts, and as are most of the squadron technicians. But the bottom line reason for all that is so that we can quickly identify and designate who should be where.
Okay, we went a little bit long, but it was great stuff. All right, so a couple of things that to keep in mind, and you may have already concluded. This is one of the most complex operations known to mankind. There's no question about it. I don't know if there's other comparable things out there in human history or what's going on currently in human affairs, but I would say that this was head and shoulders the most complex human operation ever. And you notice how it is organized. It's meticulously organized and orchestrated. The Air Boss, of course, is the conductor, if you will, of this whole operation, launching and recovering aircraft at sea. These are combat-rated aircraft. These are not training airplanes. This is not a training carrier. Although there is, in fact, or was, in the Navy inventory training carrier. These are combat rated systems, and all of the people out there are trained in various warfare specialties. They're all combat rated, and to occupy the flight deck is actually, it's a special privilege, as it turns out, if you're out there on the flight deck working to launch and recover airplanes. That's a special and very heavy responsibility, and they are all, I think everyone that I have ever encountered in my career took their jobs very, very seriously. And, of course, we have the flight crews, the pilots and the naval flight officers that assist the pilots while airborne. All of that stuff is done by the highest trained professionals that you could possibly imagine. And really, this ought to be a model for all organizations. I'm not sure that that it is, but it ought to be a model of how things ought to occur. A couple of things to keep in mind right up front. Number one is everybody is working together. There's nobody working in cross purposes. Everybody is collaborating. Everybody is cooperating. Everybody is assisting. Everybody is positioned mentally and physically to perform exceptionally well in coordination and collaboration with others who are doing performance and operating within their assigned areas or their assigned areas of responsibility and assigned areas of performance. Also, they talked about the air boss, and I'm going to give you a short little episode of me working with the air boss. So, in fact, the air boss in this audio video clip was on the USS Constellation. I was deployed on the USS Constellation as well. A little bit before this. Documentary was filmed, but I was working with, I was a squadron commander deployed on the USS Constellation, and we were operating FA Crusaders at the time, and I was working with the Air Boss. Air Boss and I were putting our heads together to figure out how we were going to operate the FA Crusader, which was a challenge in any the most challenging airplane to operate in a carrier environment happened to be the FA Crusader. And so I put my got together with the air boss and others, but in this particular case, for this particular story, I got together with the air boss, and I said, you know, we kind of have to have some some effective way in which we're going to be able to launch and recover these airplanes successfully, because it is quite challenging to do so. Okay, so the first thing was, can I get what we call priority tanking? Now you heard in the film documentary, in this audio clip, you heard that they're talking about the tankers, right? The tankers at the time were what we call the KA-6. They were a tanker version of the A-6. K means, you know, in military speak, K means tanker. H means helicopter. V means fixed-wing airplane. That's how the designations occur and line up. So the tanker version of the A-6 was a pretty good tanker. It carried a lot of fuel. It was quite stable, and it was relatively easy to fly in a carrier environment, and it was very effective. And so we had a bunch of tankers. We always had tankers airborne. Typically, in a carrier operation, a launch and recovery operation, we would have two tankers. We would have a tanker, we call it a low tanker and a high tanker, and basically that means that there's a tanker at 10,000 feet, and there's another one at 20,000 feet. Now, normally the tanker at 10,000 feet is for the departing airplanes, and the tanker at 20,000 feet is for the recovering airplanes if they need fuel. Okay, so the agreement that I had with the Airbus was that we would have priority tanking off on departure. All right, we call it off the catapult, but basically it means on departure. So once we departed the carrier, once we catapulted off the carrier and cleaned up and accelerated, we would climb up to 10,000 feet, and we would rendezvous with the low tanker. This is before every mission. So we would rendezvous, and we would take in what we call, we would top off. Top off basically means that we would, the fuel that we used taxiing around the flight deck and taking off and accelerating to climb speed and climbing up to 10,000 feet, that fuel, we would replace that fuel. All right, so we would top off our fuel tanks with the low tanker. And we did this on almost all missions. There's lots of operational reasons and safety reasons of why we did this, but we had that, and that was great. That represented the squadron commander and the air boss working together to solve a problem, and we did. And we worked together, we did solve a problem, pretty big problem, and we were successful for the duration of the deployment, which I was very happy, as you can imagine, very pleased, and that really was indicative of what goes on. It is amazing in place to be, amazing environment, because everybody is working together, right? You almost never see anyone who is working cross purposes with others or other groups. You almost never see that. It's kind of like you have gone into a new dimension, a different dimension, a different world. Once you step out on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, and see what's going on, you're in a completely different world, a completely different environment. Everybody is working in concert with one another to make this whole operation work, and it's incredible. Absolutely. Okay, so that was an example of working with the Airbus. All right, we had on the Constellation, on my deployment, we had F-14s. They were the brand-new fighters. We had F-14s. We had A-6s. We had A-7s, a great light attack airplane, the A-7 Corsair II. The A-7 was really quite remarkable and very, very effective. A-6s, of course. What can I say? The highest respect for the A-6 pilots and the Bombardier navigators, the BNs, which were the naval flight officers that were part of the flight crew. The A-6 flight crew had a crew of two, and they were day night all weather. They could employ their weapons in any weather and any time of the day or night. It was a huge improvement in the combat capabilities of the carrier air wing. They pioneered this whole area of day, night, all weather. And they deserve the highest respect. By the way, the Flight of the Intruder movie is a good example of that. Great movie. I just saw it again recently because it is so good. I've seen it a number of times, and I'll probably see it some more. Great movie, just like the Top Gun 1 movie and the Top Gun 2 movie. Those are great movies, and they're great. They're part of the thing that I love the most about being alive on this planet, which is to be able to fly airplanes. They're about flying airplanes. And what a great time that was. The most challenging thing I've ever done, but I think the highest reward. I would do it again in a heartbeat. So we have the aircraft carrier at sea. We have about how many? Well, with 5,000 people, we have about, I think we have 8 or 10 squadrons, somewhere in the vicinity of 75 to 100 airplanes, and organized in certain specific ways. Oh, and by the way, you know, before we deploy, we would go to Fallon, and this audio video clip that we just played mentioned Fallon, Naval Air Station, Fallon, Nevada. That was, it still is, by the way, it still is the great place by which we conduct our build-ups when we're getting ready to go on deployment. We have to exercise the air wing, okay, in total. So we're doing all kinds of air wing exercises. These are combat exercises. They are as realistic as we can possibly make them, these combat exercises. And they're, I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. It was great because each time you do an exercise, you get better at it. And it's amazing. You know, the learning curve is steep, and it's a great sense of satisfaction when you complete your combat training at Fallon and you're ready to deploy. The sense of satisfaction is very, very high amongst all of us, particularly amongst all of us and naval aviators that participate in this great endeavor. In terms of great endeavors, I would rate this as one of the top things. It certainly was the top thing in my life as a great endeavor. What was your great endeavor, Kevin? I would say, well, I was deployed aboard the USS Constellation, worked up at Fallon, completed my workups, successfully got through that rather grueling phase, and I was able to deploy on the USS Constellation, and I operated aboard the USS Constellation in the Pacific Theater for 11 months. Not kidding. 11 months long. And then came back to the home base. At that time, it was the Naval Air Station Miramar in San Diego, California. And went on went on 30 days of leave to rest and relaxation. You pretty much have to do that after deployment. You got to spend some recovery time because that's 11 months of grueling work. I loved it though. It was great and the highest level of satisfaction that I could imagine. And that's all part of the tip of the spear. What did we do? Exactly. What did we do? Now, I cover that in a number of ways. I think it's important for us to know the kinds of things that we did, the challenges that we faced, how we were able to overcome the challenges, not give up, but press on. Some of the time, it became very difficult, but we pressed on anyway because that was part of our job. Our job was to press on and to never give up. I just got the two-minute warning from my great audio engineer. We were involved in carrier-centric warfare. We were at the tip of the spear. And I'm going to get into more specific missions that we performed during this period of time as warriors operating at the tip of the spear. Fascinating place, fascinating thing to do. And we were operating at the high end of the conflict spectrum. In other words, we were preparing for battle against a great power enemy. And that's what we were doing. And we were, I think, I don't just think, I'm pretty well convinced that we were the best in the world. We were doing something that no other country was actually able to do. We were doing something quite unusual. And from a great power standpoint, unique. And how much time do I have left? I'm talking to my great audio. 40 seconds to go. All right. So thank you for listening. We'll cover some of the specific missions on the shows coming up. But I think you're going to find all of that stuff to be pretty fascinating. And of course, some of them are in my book, The Sonic Warrior, Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer. So don't forget that. There's also an audio book. You can listen to it on audio. You find it on Audible or any audio book platform. All of them have it. And I narrate it. And it was produced by a great audio studio in Carlsbad, California. And it's got some great stories in it. All right. That's it for this week. See you all. Oh, thank you all for listening, and see you all next week.